Dutch and True Crusaders. You are now listening to Vox Arcana, a production of Hollow Street Media. By the will of the immortal Emperor of Mankind, it has been decreed that the following broadcast of Vox Arcana may not be suitable for all ages. The views expressed on this Voxcast are solely those of the individual providing them and do not represent the opinion of this station, website, or any affiliated partner. Audience discretion is advised.
Attention on the battle fleet. This is Captain Ramaskos of the Imperial Star Cruiser Vox Arcona. Please listen carefully to the following announcement.
In accordance with the Codex Astartes, we hope that you have a productive trip to Arcona and arrive with the will to deliver the Emperor's judgment. Thank you.
Greetings, Crusaders. Welcome to Vox Arcona Mission 27, recording on Monday, February the 15th, 2016, and coming to you from the Battlefleet Charon in the Segmentum Obscurus. I am Gigabyte, and Brother Katsu has been recalled to his chapter. Therefore, the duty falls to me to take over the running of this station. Yes, Katsu has decided to take a step away from podcasting in order to spend more time with his family. As always at Hollow Street Media, family comes first. Hopefully he will rejoin us at some point in the future, but until then, I'm here to bring you the latest news from Eternal Crusade, and in his stead, I am pleased to welcome to the Voxcast, Octa. How are you doing?
Hello, Gigabytes. I'm doing pretty great. How are you?
Yes, I'm doing very well. I've been in-game this week, kicking some backside.
Enjoying the new melter gun, I hope.
Oh yes, indeed. As soon as I started using that, I started to think to myself, I am the god of hellfire.
Oh, okay, so you're actually attacking people with it. You see, I'm just writing my name in the ground.
Yes, it is very interesting how it affects the scenery, I have to admit.
Oh, I actually quite like it. I think they've done a good job.
Indeed. So, since you're new to the podcast, how about you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, your history and with GW and related products?
Well, like most people that decide to do a podcast about Warhammer 40,000, my abusive relationship with Games Workshop began in second edition, and I just kept on going, falling in and out with Warhammer 40,000. I dabbled with fantasy. And then I strayed away to other gaming systems, but eventually I came back. I've never been much into the RPG side of stuff, but my latest thing is the new Warhammer 40,000 Conquest by Fantasy Flight Games, the card game. I don't know why, it's just easy, love it, can't get enough
of it.
Very
awesome game.
Yeah, they've done a really good job.
Cool. So, let's kick off with what's been going on in the world of Eternal Crusade over the last month or so since we've been away. We have a few new weapons, as mentioned. We have the Melter Gun, which is absolutely amazing. We have the Storm Shield, finally, which is really nice. I'm really enjoying the Storm Shield. How about yourself?
Yeah, so as already mentioned, the Melter Gun, really good fun. I remember... So they kind of threw the Melter Gun out there, out of nowhere almost. And that was just after they said they definitely would not do a Flamer. Which I was a little bit sad about, because as a Blood Angel, Flamers are kind of my thing. However, the Melter Gun is kind of like a Flamer.
It kind of is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like the Grim Dark Flamer. So I'm totally okay with what they've done there.
It does seem to have some decent range on it, though.
Oh, yeah. I suspect it's... Well, I mean, obviously they're balancing things, but I suspect they're going to shorten the range and maybe up the damage a bit.
Possibly, yeah.
And when it comes to the Storm Shield, I don't much care for it, actually.
Really?
Well, yeah, I don't know. So, the first time I tried the Storm Shield, I got killed straight away. And then I realized that I needed to, you know, press left click to have it up. My bad. But no, it just doesn't work for me. I can't play it. And also, and this is the weird bit, I'm not that scared of facing up against it either.
I think the biggest thing to remember about the Storm Shield is it's great against Bolt of Fire, but terrible against Plasma and now Meltagun. So if you are facing anyone with those weapons, then you're going to get completely owned, quite frankly.
Oh no, yeah, that is fair. My go-to weapon recently has been the Plasma Gun, so...
Fair enough. We've also had the Power Fist come in, which I'm kind of okay with the Power Fist, but it's very slow.
Yeah, it is very slow. Again, you know, I think they're probably going to change that a little bit, if I had to guess. I have been killed by a Power Fist, at least.
Well, yeah, several times.
Yeah, it just comes out of nowhere. However, I remember the first time I used one, I thought, hey, I'll go assault, I'll take a Power Fist, and I'll wreck face. And actually, I did. It worked. I was living the dream. And two swings killed three people. It was brilliant. Loved it. But then something killed me. Probably a hacker, if I had to guess. And then, ever since that very first round of power fisting, I haven't got a single kill since. Yeah, it's not working for me.
I have to admit, I've got one of my custom loadouts is permanently having a power fist on it, just because I want to keep it there and I want to give it a decent chance. I have had a few lucky kills with it when you swoop down and you kind of get in there before they realize what's going on. You can get a good couple of good swings in there and get some kills in, but it's a situational weapon, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, for me, one of the bonuses is, of course, you can actually melee tanks to death, which is cool. but fluff-wise, it doesn't quite make sense that a power fist is, you know, you have to get in a few lucky shots whilst they're not paying attention. Doesn't gel.
It's very true. Well, hopefully that should be fixed eventually. Hopefully that may be changed. We've also had a new sorcerer power come in for the aspiring sorcerer. The Stream of Corruption is the first of the God-marked powers. Obviously works with the Mark of Nurgle, and puts like a poison effect on the person you're firing at. I've been the target of this many times recently, and it's got a tremendous range on it, and if you let it get on you for too long, you're pretty much dead. There's nothing that can stop you except maybe an apothecary, but
Yeah, I think I heard the dev say that because other people said it's got a really long range on it. And I think the dev said it's 100 meters, which is the same as a bolt gun. So...
Well, for me...
Yeah.
It does hurt.
Well, I can't speak to that, actually, because nobody's ever hit me with it. I don't see it too often.
You're lucky. I quite often get it on... what map is it? Black Bolt Station. Quite often I've seen a sorcerer stationed up near point C, and they're standing on the edge just firing a stream of corruption down on the people, and it's nasty.
Well, yeah, I can imagine. Although thinking about it now, the reason I've never been hit by it is because I always auto queue for the quickest queue time and almost always go to chaos, so that might explain it.
Fair enough. Well, yes, that's pretty much what's been going on in the game. We've had a few outside of game things happening. We've had a Tyranid Attack trailer come out. Oh, actually, no, tell a lie. We've had a few other bits in game. We've had our key bindings come along. That was spoke about two episodes ago, I think, on Into the Warp. But that's now in game. We can now start playing around with our key settings.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have been asking for that. It's a big thing. And apparently, I mean, obviously to most people you think key bindings, that's easy. Every game has that. You know, why aren't they in game yet? And the devs kept on telling us, no, it's really complicated. Mm-hmm. But they're here, so.
Yeah, anyone who knows anything about programming will know that any level of customization can be a little bit of a pain in the backside to program, and it takes some concentrated work, shall we say.
Well, with my extensive knowledge of having once done Hello World in Java, I can agree.
Nice. We have a new character loadout screen as well in game, actually, which I quite like. Actually, it's a much nicer, cleaner way to view your loadouts, as well as being able to create custom loadouts as well. We've got like five. I think is it five or six custom loadouts now?
I'm gonna say five.
I think it's five, isn't it? One for each class.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, which is very nice. You know, you can kind of diversify a little bit in game.
Well. Don't get me wrong, I much prefer the UI of it, obviously. However, I'm a little bit frustrated by only having five slots, and then they took away all of the presets. So, a new person going in, because obviously I started before they did this new character loadout screen. And so I jumped in, and I could have taken any weapon, plasma, stalker, bolter, storm bolter. They were all set out as presets. Now, I have to choose. And I don't know, that just seems in itself a little bit more clunky.
True. I think if they keep the standard kind of presets, though, the tactical, the devastator, etc., etc., I think if they keep those, I think people will get an idea as to, you know, what is expected of each class, at least. And then, as you know, if you go into the editing portion of it, I'm sure people will figure it out eventually, but I think, well, especially for those people who are FPS players, at least they'll certainly figure it out because it's something that they're quite used to doing anyway. But if you're not already used to that sort of thing, I can certainly see that there might be problems there.
No, sure. I can. I mean, I'm not saying it's not intuitive, because obviously, I think it's pretty obvious that there are more guns in the game than the presets. But obviously, you can't use them in the game. You have to go out, edit, come back in. And so I've often found myself wishing I had a las cannon to take out that pesky rhino or predator, but I don't have it in my loadouts.
I have to admit, I've encountered that once or twice. You go to the loadout screen, you think, oh shit, I didn't do the devastator build I meant to do.
No, yeah, I've had that, yeah.
Cool. So as I was about to mention earlier, before I realised that we have more in-game stuff, we've had a Tyranid Attack trailer come out. Very short, but a pretty nice little in-game trailer of a squad of Marines being attacked by a group of Hormigaunts, obviously heralding the arrival, or soon-to-be arrival, of the Tyranid PvE part of the game. Actually, it looks pretty nice. I do like the look of the Hormigaunts in that short little trailer. Have you seen that?
Yeah. And I've got to say, I'm very excited both for Tyranids as, you know, a faction and from a lore fluff perspective, and also just because I kind of quite like PvE. So I'm looking forward to what they do with it.
I do have to admit, I'm much more a PvE-er than a PvP-er. I tend to enjoy that a little bit more.
Well, I think we have just officially outed this podcast as Care Bears.
Might have to change the name of the podcast.
Yeah, Care Bear Arcona.
Cool. So they have mentioned, I think it was in one of the emails, that there will be a Founders Only server, which is basically a public test realm. Testing out new builds and things like that. I kind of expected this to be coming along anyway, because pretty much every MMO out there right now has a PTR of some description. Do you reckon that'll be well populated?
No. No, not really. Well, it's a nice idea, but once the game's fully launched, it doesn't really make sense to restrict a server to founders only, to be honest.
True.
And then you've got, if it is just to test the new PTR, they may as well open it to everyone to get better feedback. And if they're just being elitist about founders only can play on their own server, then I don't know, that it seems like a bit of a meh. Why bother? You're kind of not playing the game.
Well, possibly. I think this kind of was really brought out mainly because of the other point we have here, which is the Steam early access. Obviously, to get an influx of new players, behaviour of done early access on Steam. And because of that, the Founders Packs are now done. No one can buy them anymore. But you can still get, you can get an early access pack. So I think I've got a feeling this Founders Only server is to kind of make a differentiation between Founders Packs and early access packs, possibly. It does seem a little bit of an elitist move, I have to admit, and they could probably have held back on this until the launch had been and gone, and people had acclimated to the game a little bit. But the Steam Early Access is very nice, I have to admit. I've seen a lot more people in-game since that launch. What was your experience on that one?
I think the big question here is, should they have gone early access when they did? And don't get me wrong, I think it's a good idea getting on Steam. I think gauging the public interest is a good idea. Nothing wrong with that. However, I mean, even in the month it's been on Steam, they've made leaps and bounds, primarily, for me at least, in the performance factor. They patched the AMD, and I have an AMD, so that made everything much smoother for me, so that worked. But it was really bad. And then they even, with very little forewarning, opened up 60 versus 60 servers? Or was it 30 versus 30? I can't remember.
32 versus 32, I think it was, with the last one.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And now, obviously, I got this early access, as a founder, and I'm expecting it to be pretty janky. That's what it's been so far. But, I mean, you know, people that buy something early access on Steam aren't the people that want a bad playing experience.
Yeah, I mean, we know obviously the people that are buying on Steam pretty much aren't going to be DigiW fans that have been sustaining behavior in this game since its inception. They're most likely going to be your standard FPS fans, perhaps Borderlands or Team Fortress 2 type players. I think with the impending launch date coming up this year at some point, I think there was the initial launch date was supposed to be sometime this year. They had to go to early access at some point, but I think maybe they could have held off maybe until, I don't know, 2 months before the launch. Maybe gotten a little bit more of the founders in there and kind of played around with the settings a little bit more. Certainly gotten Orcs and Eldar out before early access. I think that would have been a good idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, a few new races would have been nice, but I think what they've done is made the common mistake of taking early access as an actual beta phase. And that's really not what people want when they buy early access. I mean, everybody knows Blizzard as the game company. When they release a beta, it comes out, it's basically a finished game.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people want. They don't want to beta test your game, they want a demo.
It's true, especially when you see early access, you think, oh, that's a game ready to go to the shelves, and I'm getting in there to play it before anyone else does. So the very fact of them using that statement of early access kind of puts it into the gamer's mind that this is a finished product ready to go to ship, and it's not. It's nowhere near it.
Oh, no, no, it's... If they released it now, it would be a colossal failure. Even I would stop playing. Ooh. It's like, it's not a finished game. But to be fair, I mean, on Steam, you are getting a lot of early access games that are quite terrible, really, just generally. Yeah. So, I guess they towed the line. Yes, yeah, definitely.
And how much is it on Steam? Like, last I saw, they had like a deal running on it.
Yeah, so when they released it, because they wanted to, like, they had to put it on a discount. Like, that's some team's Steam terms of service there. And it was £40 reduced to £32. But then once the sale ended, they've just changed the price to £32, which is, of course, a full price game.
Yes. I think for that amount of money, I think you could... Yeah, you really should have a full game ready to go for that amount of money.
Or maybe we're just thinking the old days, to be honest, because, I mean, EA have just released, what is it? Rainbow Six Siege, that's £50. £50 on Steam? It's outrageous.
True. It's very, very true.
So maybe that's the new price of a full game. This is, you know, half a game.
Perhaps. So yes, carrying on there, Behaviour have partnered with Bandai Namco, pretty much for the distribution and publishing of Eternal Crusade. Not a bad choice, in my personal opinion. Bandai Namco, obviously well known for games like Dark Souls 2, EVE Online, Witcher 3, some very, very good games in their back pocket. I'm quite happy with the decision myself. What about yourself?
Yeah, no, good for them. I mean, they had to pick someone. As you say, Bandai's done have published some decent games. No issues at all. I think it can only be a good thing.
Definitely. And there was a bit of an interview with Nathan and Brent at PC Gamer, mainly about the Eldar and obviously the progress of Eternal Crusade. Pretty much not much different from what we've already heard from the scene, really. Another interview about Eldar. I think they did one with MMORPG.com, I think it was, about the Eldar again. So yeah, not anything we haven't heard before, but it's a good read nonetheless, well worth having a butcher's. Did you catch that at all?
Yep. Had a read of that, and it was fine. You know, tells you a little bit about what they're up to. However, my big issue, and I feel I should probably stop being negative, but I will.
No,
sure. So the way the article is laid out is you've got all your text, and then they put a little bit of concept art in there for you, and then you've also got the renders of the Eldar models. What did you think of those?
Yeah, they looked all right. What I kind of expected from Alpha artwork, really.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, they have put that whip stamp on there, so you know it's work in progress. I mean, this is their PR. You know, this is possibly the first time anyone has seen Eternal Crusade. You know, and they'll be looking through it, and they see that, and they see those as in-game models, and I'm like, oh, okay, so we're back to Dawn of War 1, are we? Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't look finished.
No, they were very shiny, I have to admit.
They are very shiny. However, somebody pointed out that actually the in-game models of even the Space Marines are very shiny as well.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, I really do hope they grubby some of the stuff up.
Yeah, I'm sure they will, to be honest. But I did like the concept art for some of the for the Falcon Grab Tank. That did look very nice.
Oh, yes, yeah, and I'm definitely looking forward to getting that in-game.
Mm-hmm.
And one other quick note that you can see from the models there is two of them are female. So, mm-hmm. good job.
Well, Eldar are pretty much one of the only multi-gender armies out there, really. There aren't many armies in the 40k universe that use both genders in their standing army. So they have to make the representation there, really. And even the Howling Banshees, I think, in the lore stated can be either male or female, despite the fact that most people consider them female.
No, that's very correct. Well, we're about to go into it a little bit, I believe. Mm-hmm. But yes, obviously, all Eldar can choose a path, and they all have to do it. They all have to be a guardian first, I believe, and then specialise, men and women.
Yeah, correct. Well, we'll be going into the Eldar lore in our Imperial data slate in a little bit. But before that, we're moving on to the 40k universe as a whole. So, first of all, the main site. I'm going to gush a little bit because there's new Space Wars pre-orders on
the
main site. I absolutely love them. They're amazing. The new Ulrich model. Oh my god! Does that look so fucking awesome? I love it.
Nice, nice. I've got to say, the Worgen. I was unsure, but those new special characters,
they're
looking great. They're really nice.
The Worgen models. Oh baby.
So are you gonna collect Space Wolves?
Oh, I've been collecting Space Wolves for a long, long time.
And you'll be adding these to your army.
Oh, if I ever get the money.
I hear that robbery pays well.
I'm sure it does.
I wouldn't know, of course. Friend of a friend.
Of course not. But no, these do look absolutely amazing, these new Warfare models. The casting of the new models, just the meld of Space Marine and, you know, Werewolf, just looks absolutely amazing. That's my gushing over with. There are some new army books out on the iPad format. Raven Guard, Flesh Terrors, and White Scars. Codices are all out. Nice to see the lesser-known chapters getting some love there. Especially Flesh Terrors, you don't see them that often.
Now, I've been a little bit out of the hobby itself for a while. Are these codexes are already out and they've just been put on the iPad, or this is the only codex they have on the and it is on the iPad?
I think they're the only version they have of them out, to be honest. I've not seen them available to purchase, like a physical copy available to purchase anyway.
Okay, fair enough.
So I would presume that they are only on the iPad format at this point. But I'm sure if they get a lot of downloads, then that will probably be coming out in the full physical copy, which should be very nice.
Well, if I know Games Workshop, they will not pay any attention to sales or
it's
what
true.
Their customers want. So who knows?
It's very true. So moving on to Forge World. We've got some very, very nice things going on with Forge World. A new Spartan assault tank has come out on the Forge World website. Have you seen that at all?
No, I have not. I don't really head over to Forge World much because I can't afford any of it.
Tell me about it. But no, the Spartan is basically it's basically like a new version of a Land Raider. It's got some really nice sponsor mounted weapons.
Is it 40k or 30k?
40k, I believe. There should be a link in the show notes if you want to click on that.
Oh yes, I see it.
And I'll take you to the Forge World site and show you that. Looks very nice. Looks rather hench.
Oh okay, yeah, that is basically just a beefed up Land Raider.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they call it the Spartan. Don't know why. I prefer Land Raider.
I like Land Raider. I mean, who doesn't like raiding land?
I think they should have stuck with the old the Predator model, you know. Call it the Land Raider something. You know, Land Raiders artwork, maybe.
Oh, yeah, they could have done that. Yeah.
Well, they thought was a, this isn't this this last one, this next one isn't actually on the Forge World site, but this was on Bell of Lost Souls. It's sick. This is the Mastodon that's come to light recently, and this is fucking huge.
Oh man, I just opened that link.
Yeah.
Damn, I want that.
It's massive.
What's this for? What army can I jam this into?
This is Space Marine, from what I understand.
Oh yeah, okay. I see the Space Marine next to it. That's mm-hmm.
Oh. The little Space Marine standing next to it.
I love it. Love
wow. It just looks so huge. It's ridiculous, and it looks like it can open as well.
Yeah, it seems like it's got a full interior. Ooh, that's very nice.
Looks like it's got some very nice cannons on the top. And I say cannons in every sense of the word. But yeah, looks very nice indeed.
If I could afford things like that, I'd buy that.
I dread to think how much that thing's going to be on Forge World.
Well, if the Spartan assault tank was £105, I'd guess £350.
You reckon £350?
Tree-fitty.
Tree-fitty.
Definitely.
I don't know. I think they might push the boat out a little bit and go to maybe £500.
Well, if you do that, then it's the same price as the Thunderhawk, which I guess they could do. You know, the Thunderhawk's air, this is ground.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Yeah. It's possible, certainly is possible. But we'll have to wait and see. Should be quite interesting though to see how much they put that up at. In the world of video games, Battlefleet Gothic has come up with 3 new trailers recently. An Imperium trailer was the first one to come out, then a narrative trailer, and most recently they've done the Chaos trailer. I think the Imperium and the Chaos basically are giving you an overview of those particular fleets, whereas the narrative trailer actually takes a couple of cutscenes from within game, from what they say in the trailers there. Looks pretty good. Did you get a chance to look at those at all?
Yes, I've seen all of them. I was surprised by the narrative trailer. I didn't think they would go with that art style for it, because obviously it's not quite traditional 40k Grimdark, but I really like it. Yeah, I think they've done a good job.
Mm.
And when it comes to the Imperium and Chaos in-game trailers, ooh, loving it. Can't wait to get my hands on
Planet Killer.
I think they've done a really good job on just the aesthetic in general. So I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on it and flying a ship around into a sun or whatever it is you do.
Giving a full broadside to an Emperor class cruiser.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably fire off the wrong way and blow up an asteroid, but yeah.
I think it'd be quite interesting to give that Planet Killer a bit of a run around. That'd be quite fun.
I actually rather hope they do let us in some way use the Planet Killer on a planet.
They totally should. Really should.
Well, it makes perfect sense, and then it creates, you know, an asteroid field.
Yeah.
Perfect.
No, totally. So that brings us to the end of the news, and that brings us to the Imperial Data Slate. Our Imperial Data Slate for today is the Eldar, and as always, we start with a quote. Would you like to take the quote there, Octa?
Why not? Okay. The mind of the Farseer is utterly inhuman in its depth and complexity. Without mercy or moral feeling, his consciousness stands upon the edge of spiritual destruction. That he does not fall must be as a result of constraints and balances that only an Eldar could understand. To a mere human, it is yet another reminder that we are but children in comparison to that ancient and powerful race.
Nice. So yes, the Eldar, the hippie, knife-eared dirt worshippers, in the words of Katsu. Superficially, the Eldar appear very similar to humans, though they are generally taller and slimmer, with sharper features and pointed ears. They are, in fact, space elves. They are long-lived by human standards, and most will live more than 1,000 years unless they die from accident or disease. Eldar also have much faster metabolic rates than humans, and their cardiac and neurological systems are more advanced. These traits manifest in their vastly heightened reactions and agility compared to humans. To them, humans seem to move in slow motion with a certain degree of awkwardness, while to humans, the Eldar can move with a distracting grace and can be blindingly fast in combat. Those wanting to play Eldar in Eternal Crusade, as we said in a previous episode, make sure your computer can handle accelerated graphics. You're going to need it. As a race, they have a high level of psychic ability, which serves as the foundation of their technology. The Eldar that actively cultivate their psychic potential seem to exhibit a much extended lifespan as well, one proportional to their prowess. The Farseers of the Eldar can live for several thousand years. Eldar are mentally far superior to humans and feel emotions much more strongly, requiring the Eldar to exercise constant restraint to avoid mental breakdown. Eldar seem to reproduce in stages, with new genetic material being added by their father to the developing embryo over an extended period. This process is ill understood, but Eldar autopsies are suggestive of it. It is, however, known that the Eldar gestation cycle is much longer than for most races. And they are indeed a dying species. Also, would you like to go into the history there a little bit?
I'd love to. So, once, 10,000 years ago, the Eldar were among the most powerful and dominant races of the galaxy, dominating a significant portion of the galaxy and securing their prosperity. Although there were several other races of advanced technology and military power, none were in a position to seriously threaten the state of the Eldar nation. When it came, the disaster was internal. Consumed by arrogance and with no need for substantial work or labour, the Eldar began to pursue any curiosity or desire. I've lost where I am. Hold on. I was typing into the Z. Right, my bad. Okay. Rapidly, cult devoted to exotic knowledge, physical pleasure, and ever more outrageous entertainment sprang up. It did not take long for many of the Eldar to take a darker path, descending into dark study, instant fulfillment, and unbridled violence, beginning the fall of the Eldar. Many of the Eldar grew uneasy with the actions of their comrades, and the wisest of the seers warned that the path could lead only to evil. Disgusted, some of the Eldar left the central worlds of the Empire to settle on the outlying regions, while others stayed to try and alter the path of their race had taken. While this would have been destructive within any society, it was even more damaging for the Eldar. Within the parallel realm of the warp, the psychic emanations of these activities began to gather, strengthened by the souls of departed followers and cultists. As the Eldar's vices grew, this collection did as well, until it eventually came into a life of its own. It finally came to consciousness as Slaanesh, devourer of souls and doom to the Eldar. For the psychic scream of its birth tore the souls from all the Eldar within 1,000 light years of it. Its awakening was so forceful that it tore a hole between physical space and the warp, plunging the Eldar homeworlds into a limbo of partial existence. This region is now known as the Eye of Terror, and is now the home of the forces of chaos. Many Eldar survived the fall and remain trapped within the Eye on the homeworlds of the Eldar, the Crone World, and are enslaved to Slaanesh. Since this time, which is known only as the Fall, the Eldar have been a broken and scattered people, lacking cohesion and purpose. The Eldar population is constantly dwindling.
Yes, indeed, and the Eldar society is split into four main subcultures, those being the Craftworld Eldar, the Exodites, the Harlequins, and the Outcasts / Dark Eldar. In brief, the Craftworld Eldar are pretty much the Eldar that you meet on a daily basis. They're the ones who left the homeworlds of the Eldar a little bit late, just before the fall. They left on planet-sized ships created from Wraithbone, took part of their planets with them, and started roaming the stars looking for a new home. The Exonites, several of the craft worlds of particular note are the ones we know in Eternal Crusade. Orthway, Biltan, Samehan, Alaitok, Iandan, and Altansar. I think the only one we don't have is... It's either Alaitok or Iandan, if I remember correctly. But I can't remember off the top of my head.
I'm afraid I can't help you there.
So I'll give you a second. Yallah. Alaitok is the only one we don't have in-game. We have Ulthway, Biltan, Samhan, Iandan, and Altansar, which is the one voted for by the players. The Exodites were the largest group to flee the homeworlds of the Eldar before the fall. They left to find new pastures, so we say, that what they could term the Maiden Worlds. They preached out against the changes in the Eldar society, but were ignored or treated as narrow-minded. As such, they were saved from the Tate of Chaos and formed colonies on the edge of the galaxy, far from their homeworlds, and the now expanded Eye of Terror. Most have reverted to a more agricultural state of existence, and as such are mocked by many of the craft world Eldar as being backward. Although they have maintained a certain level of technology, they are also generally a more accepting people, taking in Eldar outcasts where Craftworld Eldar would push them away. They are supported mainly by Biltan and are often protected by the forces of that Craftworld. Of particular note, the Exodites in some of the previous codices were well known for having dinosaur riders, which I thought was absolutely fucking awesome.
Well, how could you not?
Exactly. Would you like to cover the Harlequins and the Dark Eldar a little bit?
Okay, so Harlequins. These guys are followers of the Eldar god, the Great Harlequin, also known as Segorak, or the Laughing God, who was the only one of the two Eldar gods to survive the fall. They move throughout the Webway in groups and perform impressive displays of mime and acrobatics, telling the many strange and wonderful stories of the Eldar past, but also the dark and dangerous plays of the fall. Harlequins are not only performing artists, but devastating fighters as well. They will appear to fight with the Eldar Brethren, particularly in close combat. Their primary task, however, is to guard the Black Library of Chaos from intruders, and have done so ever since its inception thousands of years ago. They rarely communicate with members outside of their group, but will call for help if intruders overwhelm them. And that brings us to Outcast / Dark Eldar. Now, personally, I prefer Dark Eldar to Eldar, but that probably says more about me than Eldar. So,
a little bit.
So, Eldar outcasts and pirates are ill-defined. They're consisting of actual outcasts, pirates, raiders, but also including long-ranging fleets of craftsworlds and other groups of mistakenly identified Harlequins and Dark Eldar. To Craftworld Eldar, piracy is shunned, although some Eldar will leave their craftworld for a short period to experience life outside of the strict regime that was put in place to defend against the great enemy. Eventually, however, most do return to their ordered and strict lives. Some Eldar, however, are forced into piracy and exile through their own actions, those who refuse to follow the strict rules of the craftworld, for example. Often they form together and hire themselves out to human worlds and commanders as mercenaries. Some pirates, however, are less noble and perform the dark arts that led to the fall in the first place. They are generally quick-tempered and unpredictable, features which are usually suppressed while on a craft world. They are often refused access to a craft world, or, if not, they are only very briefly allowed access to use their dangerously unbound minds, which may attract predators and demons to lodge in the craft world's wraithbone structure. They may also distract the young and inexperienced Eldar on a craft world with notions of a romantic and daring existence. So basically, they don't let anyone have any fun when you're on a craft world.
Indeed, they don't. Because fun leads to chaos. Fun is the path to the dark side.
And chaos leads to the dark side, yeah.
Speaking of paths, the Eldar follow a number of paths, the main one is known as the Eldar Path, which leads all who follow it into the service of the Guardians. The Guardians being the standing militia for all the craft worlds. And then basically the paths are how the craft world Eldar kind of manage their passions so that they don't cause another birthing of a Chaos God, which kind of would be another bad thing. Among the paths that Eldar can follow once mastering the Eldar path, we have the Path of Awakening, which is a path in which Eldar learn how to analyze their surroundings. Those trained on this path can notice things that would seem insignificant or impossible to see, even to a normal Eldar. The Path of Awakening is the polar opposite to the Path of Dreaming, which we'll come on to later, as it focuses on looking without rather than within. The Path of Awakening is usually a prelude to the Path of the Artisan.
Which, of course, takes us to the Path of the Artisan. Now, this is a relatively common path. Upon the Path of the Artisan, there are many smaller avenues, such as the Path of the Poet, the Path of the Sculptor, maybe even the Path of the Author, and so on. Even within each of these minor paths, there are conflicting schools of style, such as the school of Hithrynir, which teaches that the artist should become as much of a part of his art as he can be, with its followers often bleaching their skin and marking themselves with stylistic tattoos.
The next path is the Path of Command, also known as the Path of the Leader, is for those Eldar with a passion for military command and strategy. Its members are the Autarchs, who tread this path to better command larger forces of Eldar warriors. To enter this path is expected to have completed several previous military paths already. The Autarchs, as those who know the Eldar Codex will know, are the lord choices you can have in an Eldar army. Very powerful. And indeed, in Eternal Crusade, they are a hero class.
And quite the opposite of that is Path of the Dreamer. This is a meditative path undertaken by many Eldar, in which the Eldar learns to control and direct their dreams, which they can stay entranced in for days at a time. During these dreams, it is usual for another Eldar to act as a dream watcher.
Following that, we have the Path of Grief, which is a path in which one grieves for the death and suffering at Eldar remembrance services and funerals. This allows the other Eldar to remember without succumbing to the emotions that would be in violation of the path, the Eldar path, and tempt to the wrath of She Who Thirsts, otherwise known as Slaanesh.
Or my ex-girlfriend. Now, yeah, that was low-hanging fruit, I'm sorry.
Nice.
Okay, so next up we have the Path of the Mariner. These guys are the crew of the Eldar Space Fleet. Those who seek this path often wish to see the sights of the galaxy and often seek inner peace after a period in which they feel lost, also known as the Path of the Steersman.
And then we have the Path of the Outcast. Yes, indeed, being an outcast is in fact a career choice. Those who desert the Eldar path are known as outcasts and follow the Path of the Outcast. The intensely capable Eldar mind sometimes rebels against the highly structured delineation of achievement which the Eldar Path offers. Without the protection of the Eldar Path, an individual is likely to be driven crazy and eventually succumb to self-destructive urges. The worst fate of all is the Path of Damnation, but no Eldar will speak of this aberration, and so almost nothing is known about it. Sometimes young, inexperienced, or disgraced Eldar leave their craft worlds to wander among the stars. Thereby, they break out of the cycle of paths and go through a period of great danger. This period is sometimes called the Path of the Outcast, Path of Wandering, or Path of Damnation. But these names are technically wrong, as the Eldar are completely outside. These Eldar are completely outside of the cycle of paths. Most of the time, they become rangers. Some eventually return to their craft worlds and to the safety of the paths. Those who are unable to return for one reason or another eventually become pathfinders. Other outcasts become pirates, raiders, and corsairs.
Then we have the Path of Service. Now, this is a path in which Eldar give themselves over to the service of others. Eldar do this out of the same sense of duty that inspires some to take more militant paths. They perform jobs the humans may describe as menial.
So like they're the caretakers and the cleaners and things like that?
Which, as we all know, is a noble profession.
Oh, of course. If someone doesn't clean, it gets very dirty.
That is what I find in my bedroom, yeah.
Next one we have the Path of the Seer, also known as the Path of the Witch, which is actually the longest, most treacherous, most complex, and rarest of all the paths. So why anyone would tread it, I don't know. Its members are the Psychic Seers. The Spirit Seers are specialists in the handling of Spirit Stones for the raising of the Wraith Guards and Wraith Lords. The Warlocks previously underwent the Path of the Warrior, which we'll come onto in a second, and now lead the Eldar into battle. The Farseers are lost upon the Path of the Seer, and are the most powerful Eldar psychers of all. Bonesingers are seers who use their psychic talents to manipulate the growth of Wraithbone. The ultimate fate of a Farseer is to become wholly part of the craft world as a Crystal Seer.
And then, of course, we have the Path of the Warrior. Now, this, of course, is arguably the most relevant path for Eternal Crusade and, in fact, 40k as a whole, because you do a lot of fighting. Mm. Now, in the Path of the Warrior, members are Aspect Warriors. Those who lose themselves upon this path become Exarches, or Exarchs. The most widely known aspects are the Dire Avengers, the Howling Banshees, the Striking Scorpions, the Fire Dragons, the Swooping Hawks, the Dark Reapers, the Crimson Hunters, and the Warp Spiders. There are several lesser known types of Aspect Warriors, some even unique to a single craft world. One of the more rare aspects are the Shining Spears, also known as the aspect of the Eagle Pilot, who is the Eldar equivalent to a Fighter Pilot. Now, it must be mentioned that Guardians are not treading this path at all. They are following other civilian paths, being summoned to fight for the craft world for the duration of the given emergency.
I believe part of the Eldar path, just the Eldar path, is kind of like the Guardian thing anyway. It's like you do your duty to the Eldar.
Yes, as I understand it, every Eldar has to do, not conscription, whatever it's called, you know, your term of service.
Your term of service, that's right. Yes, that's the path that an Eldar can follow. Eldar do have a kind of religion. They do have a pantheon, or had a pantheon of gods. They are quite spiritual people. As I say, they did have a pantheon up until the birth of Slaanesh, who kind of killed all their gods except two, which was Caelum Enchikain, kind of was killed, but broke himself up into several pieces to reside with inside the craft worlds, and became the avatars of Cain. And the other one is the Laughing God, who escaped into the Webway and is worshipped by the Harlequins, as we mentioned earlier. While the Eldar still revere all their gods and preserve their stories within the mythic cycles, they do not call on them for aid or hope their intervention any longer. Still, there is a prophecy telling of the return of the Eldar gods and how they will battle and destroy Slaanesh as a unified pantheon. Whether this is anything but an old myth remains to be seen. And that brings us to the end of today's show. And again, as always, we finish with a thought for the day. And as our newest member to the cast, would you like to take the thought for the day there, Octa?
I can't think of a reason why I can say no. All the stars in the sky cannot blot out the hateful glare of the red moon's eye. The birthing place of the great enemy pulses with all the malice of a demon that is dreaming, casting its shadow over all we have ever done and all we ever shall. Eldrad Ulthuan.
I am Gigabyte. That was Octa. We are Eternal Crusade, and we shall see you again.
Goodbye, everyone.
The Adeptus Terra thanks you for tuning into tonight's broadcast of Vox Arcana, a production of Holosuite Media. Be sure to check our website, iTunes, or Stitcher Satellite Radio for our remastered Voxcasts and more. You can follow us on Twitter at Vox Arcana, or if you have any questions or comments, please send an email to voxarcona@gmail.com. Return next week for yet another communique from the Voxarcona.